Jihad Radio. Kevin Barrett. My guests are the best in the radio business. If you don't think this show is 12 cuts above public radio, and even a couple of cuts above Democracy Now! And the rest of the pseudo-alternative foundation-funded media, well, you've got poor taste. Let's see, who are we going to bring on today? Among my long list of great guests telling hard truths, and they're rarely heard in the corporate mainstream, today we're going to hear from the FBI's latest setup victim. No, it's not some Muslim teenager. Naive or even retarded Muslim teenagers seem to be the FBI's number one victims these days, the people that the FBI loves to foist their own terror plots on. Hi, I'm with the FBI. You're a retarded Muslim teenager. Would you like to join my plot to blow up the Sears Tower?
Sure, I would love to do that.
Ah! Terror bust! No, we have actually another target here who's not even Muslim. He's a nice, white, reputable American citizen, upstanding guy, has run for high office, including governor of California, served in medium office as mayor of Bellflower, California. I'm talking about Art Olivier. I met Art in Tehran, and he's been back and forth to Tehran probably almost as often as I have, in my case, three times in 2 years. But Art's in the movie business, and he's trying to cut deals with the Iranians because the usual suspects in the Hollywood Mafia are not interested in him anymore, if they ever were. So let's hear about this problem with the FBI. Welcome, Art Olivier. How are you?
Hey, Kevin. Doing good.
Yeah, good to have you back. We've talked about all kinds of stuff on the show. Like we've talked about ley lines and Freemasons. We've talked about the Liberty Incident and Zionism and false flag terrorism. And now we're going to have to talk about the FBI. You got worse treatment coming and going from Iran than I did, which is saying something. I mean, I'm a radical Muslim truth jihadi, and I make no bones about saying so. And still, I've pretty much gone back and forth without a whole lot of harassment. But you, they seem to be, laying for you at the airport and stuff, and now they're trying to set you up. Tell us a little bit about your encounters with the FBI and so on.
Yeah, it's pretty apparent that I'm on the terrorist watch list. I went through the Freedom of Information Act to get information from the Department of Homeland Security to find out why I'm on the terrorist watch list. They said they wouldn't tell me. They wouldn't confirm or deny anything. It was completely useless. It happened after the second time I went to Iran. I came back and Customs was waiting for me. So they brought me into an interrogation room, took all my stuff, took my cell phone and my wallet, and took everything into another room. I'm sure they downloaded all my contacts from my emails. And then the FBI came in and they brought me into another room and interrogated me, asked why I went to Iran. The one guy, I could tell he was a profiler. So he's trying to find out the motivation for me to go to Iran. Was it to self-aggrandization or something, I think, is what he was coming up with. And then he asked me a question, and apparently I looked down to the left or something, and that was an indication that I was hiding something. So he said, "You're hiding something.
Don't ever look down into the left."
Yeah.
Remember, it's up and to the right, like the Kennedy head snap. It's we're back and to the right, whatever. Just not down and to the left.
Right. So, after he said that, I said, "What? What are you talking about?" So, anyway, it took me 2 hours to get out there. My wife was. I had texted her when I landed, and in 2 hours, I wasn't out of the airport, and she was going crazy trying to figure out what happened to me.
And they won't let you make a phone call. To tell
no, they take my call. They take my phone, and they won't give it back.
Did you try to borrow one of the FBI agents' cell phones? Hey, man, can I borrow your cell phone just to call my wife?
They don't really care about that. So I spent 2 hours there. Finally got out. Finally got a hold of my wife. She picked me up. She was panicking, and then, of course, every other time I fly internationally, I can't have my wife pick me up. So I have to get a taxi or something to get home because I know that customs is going to be waiting for me. So anytime I go to the airport, I'm not allowed to get a boarding pass online like you usually do. I have to get it at the airport. And then when they print it out, it has all these S's on the bottom, meaning security risk. So when the person behind the counter, she sees that, and she just, you know, looks at, has this panic look on her face.
She's taking a look at you. Boy, you're a pretty scary-looking guy, Art.
Well, you know, I'm big. I guess I could be pretty scary-looking. And when you have all those S's in there, they know that I'm a terrorist, or you know, I'm on the terrorist watch list.
Well, you know, wearing that fake Bin Laden beard probably doesn't help your cause. Or do you take that off before you go to the airport?
No, I usually use the turban on.
There you go. Isn't this ironic, though? I mean, we're told that Iran is the police state. Oh, you're going to Iran. That's really dangerous. Isn't that a horrible police state over there? Yeah, right. So the security in Iran is, you know, considering the fact that they actually have a real terrorism problem over there, is pretty human, you know. It's, I mean, they'll search you once in a while and stuff, but they're very human about it and smile. And it's the America feels a lot more like a police state than Iran does.
Yeah, when I travel from city to city in Iran, when I go to the airport, all you do is you walk through a metal detector.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yep. I think I've been searched once in Iran. I've traveled around in Iran and gone back and forth three times, and only once did I even get searched. And the guy who did it was kind of apologetic, and, you know. So it's, and they have these attacks. Their physicists are getting murdered by Israeli agents all the time. You know, CIA and Israeli paid stooges are blowing up mosques and slaughtering people left and right. And they still are human about it. Here in the U.S., we have zero terror problem. It's all false flag to the extent that there is anything. And, you know, you're more likely to drown in your bathtub or be hit by lightning than to be killed by a terrorist. And yet we've got this gulag. It's completely insane. So go on. Tell us more about your encounters.
Well, so once I get my boarding pass, then I'll walk away from the counter. And there will literally be TSA agents running after me.
And wow, it's, you know, I guess you're the big excitement of their day.
Yeah. So I get preferential treatment. I get to go to the front of the line, and they do an enhanced screening of me. I have to go through the naked body scanner and get the pat down. You know, usually you get one or the other.
They must really like you.
Yeah, I have to do both. Oh yeah. Yeah, they get very affectionate. They go through all of my belongings. They put these little fabrics on them, and they run them through an explosive detector, and to see if I'm carrying any explosives on. And so they finally let me through. And then on my last trip to Iran via Dubai, we was going on an A380, the big double-decker plane that holds like 500 people. And I was one of the last ones to board. Well, customs grabbed me before I got onto the plane. And they were asking me the same questions that TSA would. You know, I think you guys already did this. They go, no, we're customs. That was TSA. And so the...
Didn't you explain that you're perfectly well acquainted with American customs?
I am acquainted with it. I don't appreciate them, the new customs they have now. So one of the agents, the customs agents, she pulls out a business card of mine, and she's waving it around. She goes, look, Operation Terror.
Yeah, you probably should have picked another name for that movie.
So, again, I had to explain to them, you know, that's a movie that I had produced. And anyway, they asked me all these questions, and they had this one guy that was... I guess, you know, he's a pretty good sized guy, but, you know, I was, you know, when you're my size, people don't look that big. And he was trying to intimidate me, you know, and it took me a while to figure this out. Oh, this guy's trying to intimidate me. And then they brought me into it was like a prison cell right next to the boarding gate. And they brought me in there, and they had me put my hands up against the wall. And as I was walking in, there was a Muslim guy that was walking out, and he was visibly shaken, you know, what had happened to him inside that interrogation room. And so when I went in there, they put my hands up against the wall, and they did another search. They put me behind this metal table and they were, you know, asking me these same questions. Why are you going to Iran? What do you do there? Who do you meet with? All these same questions.
I've heard those questions a couple of times too.
Yeah. Yeah. And so finally I got out of there and got onto the plane. And as I was walking down the aisle, the pilot apologized to the passengers. We're sorry. We had a
dangerous terrorist trying to get on the plane. Here he is, this guy.
one of our passengers had to go through an enhanced screening. And yeah, as I was walking down the aisle, and everybody's looking, oh, there's the terrorist.
Oh, man.
But I actually held up the plane for a while to depart so they could do their enhanced screening. And so then when I got back, I saw the customs agents, and I was familiar with one of them there. And I go, oh, you guys looking for me? Oh, yeah.
Well, you're that guy who groped me. Yeah.
Now, this guy was pretty nice. This one customs agent, you know, he would ask me questions, and he could figure it out. You know, this guy is not a terrorist. And so while they were looking through my phone and all my belongings and everything, all my luggage, you know, they rip up all of my luggage out of the luggage, and I have to try to put it all back into place. And they go through everything. And while they're doing that, this guy and I, we were talking about motocross and stuff. He rides dirt bikes, and I used to be a motocross champion. And again, it takes a couple of hours. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I get a phone call from a guy named Dario. And Dario wants to look at a house, a townhome in Lakewood. I'm a realtor. Making movies is kind of a side thing, you know. It's more of a hobby than a...
Just a hobby.
Yeah.
So I lose going to out. Iran, making movies, and scaring all the authorities is just your hobby.
That's my hobby. Selling real estate is my business. And so he wanted to look at this house, and he wanted to look at another one, and he wanted to meet me at the Starbucks in Bellflower on Wednesday. So I set up this appointment, and I make an appointment to look at this house and to look at another one, and do all the, copying all the paperwork and everything. Meet with this guy at 10 a.m. Wednesday morning, and he says, oh, yeah, I really wanted to meet you. He definitely looked like he was Iranian. I saw your movie when I was in Iran. I go, really? Yes, yes, yes. And well, it turns out he didn't want to look at any houses. Hmm. That was just a ruse. And what he wanted to do was... he talked a little bit about my movie, and then he talked about the horrible sanctions that were in Iran, and I agreed with him. And then he said he needed some help. He wasn't specific what it was, and he talked about the people couldn't get their medicine, and we came across that with some of the guests at the New Horizons. They couldn't get their medicine while they were in Iran because of the sanctions. And I talked a little bit about the Boeing deal where Boeing is trying to work out a deal with Iran, and because Iran wants to buy $400 billion worth of planes in the next 10 years, Boeing is trying to get these sanctions lifted. And apparently they had some sanctions lifted where they were allowed to sell some of the spare parts to Iran.
Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing because, when you and I are flying around Iran, either going to Mashhad or something from Tehran on the local Iranian airline, it's good to know that they have some real spare parts. They're not having to carve them themselves out of wood.
Right. Yeah. Of course, they don't carve them out of wood. But the amount of testing that goes into those spare parts that we do. I used to be an engineer at Boeing. And that is not done on the bootleg parts that Iran has to get to put on their planes. You just don't have that level of sophistication. And so a lot of the airplanes do crash in Iran because of the worn out parts or the bootleg parts that they put on the plane. So, yeah, it's a really good thing to have the correct parts on those planes. And, so I said, well, as being a politician, an engineer, I could possibly help out working on trying to relieve some of the sanctions. Doing some lobbying work, and then He goes, no. What we want to do is we want to send electronics to Iran.
Uh-oh, big red flag.
Yeah, and I'm going, electronics? You know, I'm thinking, wait a minute, you know, you can't do that. I'm thinking, what's this guy up to? And so I said, no, that's nothing I can help you out with. Only one, you know, I go, look, I got, you know, the FBI, they read all my emails, they listen to my phone calls. That's just, you know, I'm not the right guy. You don't want me. And he goes, no. Here, I give you an email address. You know, he gives me this Hotmail account email address. And here's a password. So you don't send emails. You just go on, you log on, you take the password, and I leave you messages. You know, if you do this, everybody in Iran will love you, and then of course you will be compensated, you know, with greatly compensated for your efforts.
Wow. So they're looking for high profile dissidents who have American surveillance all over them to smuggle their parts.
Okay. Right. Yeah. You know, and afterwards I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. Well, if this guy has any ties to the Iranian government, why would he contact me in California and not in Iran? You know, that doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah.
And so then later in the conversation, his eyes were twitching back and forth, really fast. I'd never seen anything like it. You know, and later I looked up shifty-eyed. You know, I'm thinking, well, a shifty-eyed person is somebody that's lying, right? No, it's somebody that is thinking, and their eyes shift back and forth because I'm talking to him, and I think at the same time, somebody in his ear is talking to him. I think he had a little speaker inside of his ear, and they were asking him questions to ask me.
Yeah, sort of like when Bush was debating John Kerry and trying to keep up with Karl Rove speaking into his earpiece.
Right. Yeah. And he asked me. He goes, "Well, have you ever met the Supreme Leader?" No, I never met the Supreme Leader. Well, you met the President. You know, no, I haven't met the President. He started asking all these questions. You know, they're trying to get some information out of me, and you know, none of them pertained to what I was doing. You know, but why did you contact Iran in the first place? You know, and I said, well, I submitted my movie to a film festival there. You know, and it was the Fosh Film Festival where we actually had a world premiere, and it was only because at that moment in time is right when we were finishing post-production on the movie, and they were the first ones to ever be able to show the movie in a film festival. But so I had to leave. I had to go, you know, I had an appointment at noon, and I left, and then I'm starting to put it together. You know, he's asking me a lot of the same questions that this FBI agent at the airport was asking me.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured it's got to be the same guy. And I, of course, I never went onto that email account, and apparently I threw away the paperwork with his address. Well, the next week, I see that FBI agent walking up my driveway. Oh. And he starts asking me, you know, I mean, first thing that he says, "Hi, you remember me?" And I said, "Yes. And I didn't appreciate what you did last week at Starbucks." And he goes, "Oh, you think I had something to do with that?" And I go, "Yes." And he goes, "Oh, no. I had nothing to do with that." And I go, "Bullshit." And he goes, "No, we're too busy to do anything like that. We were following this guy. He made contact with you. They ran your license plate number. And that's why I'm here." And I go, "Yeah, right."
So, looks like you wandered into a den of espionage, and it's not exactly the den of espionage that used to be the so-called U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
Right. So, you know, that's, of course, he started asking more questions, and I said, "Look, hey, you know, I'll tell you what, you know, I told him about the email and the password, and let me get that for you." And I looked for it. I didn't have it. I guess I'd already thrown it away. But the email address was a Persian name, a dot, another Persian name, I think some numbers, and hotmail.com. And it wasn't Dario. The Dario was the name that the guy had given me to over the phone. But yeah, it was definitely a scam. And now I got another problem. I've got I'm working on a Polish distribution deal. And the guy was trying to wire me money, and we've been sending emails. And now he sent me like a half a dozen emails that I keep responding to, and he keeps telling me, he goes, why aren't you responding to my emails? So somehow they're blocking the emails that I send to him to give him information on how to transfer the money to me for this deal. And I can't get through to him.
Have you tried using an alternate account? Like, it's really easy to set up like a Gmail account or these various, you know, you could set up another, you know, other email accounts. I've had this issue before too, where I get blocked, and usually if I go to a second account, I'm able to get through.
Yeah, no, I've tried two different accounts. Neither one will go through.
Really?
So I've
How about Skype?
Yeah,
on Skype you can communicate in real time, and that way
all I have is his email address. But yeah, I got to do some more research, try to figure out how to get around this. I sent an email with the information to the a Polish American that had put me in contact with this guy. He's a producer of the movie The Reflecting Pool, and so I sent that information to him, and but I haven't heard back from him, so I think they're blocking that too. Anytime I try to send this information out, contact information, I think they're blocking it because I haven't been able to get through. So I got to find somebody that I can send that information to, who can send that information into to this guy, because they're making it very difficult because all I have is just his email address.
Wow, sounds like they're really working to disable the purveyors of conspiracy theories, which is what Cass Sunstein, who is then Obama's information czar, said should be done to try to stop the spread of conspiracy theories. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if that's going on. I just had another issue here where, I've had a bunch of computer issues since I got going on this Charlie Hebdo book that just came out, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Free Thinkers Question the French 9/11. And I've been told by contacts who have a lot of contacts in French intelligence and Algerian intelligence that certain people in France are completely freaked out about my book. And I've had these various issues. The most recent one is that as of today, I cannot get into my CreateSpace account, which is with, you know, the publishing account for the book. So to order books for myself, to send books to other places, like for my book tour, I can't get in there. And there's an error message, and I've contacted them to find out what the problem is, and I haven't heard yet. But it could be some kind of cyber espionage, or rather cyber sabotage. Somebody could have hacked in there and screwed it up. Or it could be that there's some kind of complaint, because the ADL has been pushing back really hard against this book, repeated attacks. And so maybe, I know that they just, I believe, was it the ADL or somebody just went after Amazon for selling Holocaust denial books. So there's a push to limit what they can sell on Amazon. And CreateSpace is the Amazon affiliate. My book, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11, is being sold through Amazon. And I just wonder if somebody's not coming up with some kind of pretext to complain to CreateSpace, which is publishing or rather printing the book, and finding some kind of pretext to try to logjam it to prevent the book from getting out. But yeah, they apparently this kind of thing is becoming more and more common.
Yeah, my sales just all of a sudden of sales of the movie have dropped about 80%. And I've been trying to track it down, figure out, you know, what happened, and I can't. The profits from the sales just goes really into the loan that we took out to make the movie, so that's becoming difficult now to pay the loan off the payments on the loan that we made to make the movie.
Now, are the sales going mostly through Amazon or through what channel?
No, I get, usually through OperationTerror.com, people buy the DVD direct from me, and then we also have it on BXH, I think it is, .com, mm-hmm. Where people can watch it, download it and watch it there. And then we have some on Amazon too. You know, the Amazon one. Well, Amazon, I didn't really sell much, and I'm still, you know, just selling a little bit there. But through my website, yeah, it's gone down. It's gone down over 80%.
And did that happen all at once?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, that's strange. I wonder if there's some kind of hacking or denial of access. Sometimes they mess with the search engines. You know, that was the way that they stopped 9/11 and Operation Gladio from going viral a couple of 9/11 anniversaries ago. That was made by Russia Today, the Truth Seeker program, and it was heading into the millions of views, about to become a mega hit, sort of like Loose Change. And then suddenly, it just disappeared from all the search engines, including the YouTube search engine. And people couldn't find it anymore, so it stopped going viral. And even when people tried to email their friends with the URL of this YouTube, the emails would just disappear into cyberspace, and there would be no bounce back, but they would never arrive. So it appeared that there was a big cyber sabotage campaign against Russia Today's 9/11 and Operation Terror. And so once they stopped from going viral right at the anniversary, when it was... You know, when it mattered, then after the anniversary, when it wasn't going to go viral so fast, this stopped and it showed up again in the search engines. But if your website is being somehow messed with in the search engines, that would mean that fewer people are finding it and fewer people are ordering the book, rather the film.
Yeah. You know, I had that happen with a video that I put out shortly after the Sandy Hooks. Sandy Hoax. Yeah. In that video, it showed Emily Parker sitting on the president's lap after she had died a couple days earlier, and it was called "Absolute Proof." Sandy Hook was staged, and the video, it just started going viral really fast. Within was it 2 weeks, I think I had over 400,000 views, and it was just taken off. It became the in YouTube, if you typed in only Sandy Hook, that was the number one video. It surpassed CNN, ABC, everybody, and with just those two words, Sandy Hook. They did a show on CNN with Anderson Cooper. He was talking about the video, and they had a whole bunch of people go on to that video and say that it was offensive. So then YouTube tagged the video as being offensive. So anybody that went to that video would have to go through this other layer of looking at an offensive video, and that stopped it from going any further. So it stopped like at, you know, at 450,000 views.
Yeah. I wonder how often they use that trick. I'm sure quite often, actually.
Yeah. You know, another thing that the biggest thing I think that was done when I made the movie Operation Terror, my idea was to market it through the Jones Network. I was going to pay to be on his radio show, on InfoWars and Prison Planet websites. And so I gave the producers over there a copy of the movie, and they said, okay, we need another one. So I gave them another one. And, you know, was trying to make out a deal to advertise with them, and they would not allow me to advertise on anything affiliated with Alex Jones.
I guess your money isn't good enough for Alex Jones.
Yeah, you know, people say, well, you know, Alex Jones, he's just a money grubbing guy. You know, no, he wouldn't take my money.
Mm-hmm. It makes you wonder. You know, that's one of the most significant pieces of evidence that I know of to support Gordon Duff's hypothesis that Alex Jones is some kind of deep cover Zionist agent or somehow compromised or on the Zionist payroll. Of course, Gordon thinks everybody except him and me are on the Zionist payroll, and he's not sure about me and perhaps not even about himself. He's a little paranoid. But when you hear that Alex Jones will not take your money to advertise Operation Terror, that really makes me wonder about Alex.
Right, yeah, because, you know, Alex Jones is a gatekeeper, and Operation Terror, that appeals to people outside of the gate, you know, where people, you know, inside of his gate can take this movie and show it to their friends and family, and then, you know, they'll sit down and watch, you know, entertaining movie, feature film for 90 minutes, and then they can come away with it, the idea that, oh, you know, this really could have been a conspiracy by the government, you know, so it it's not something that he's really allowed, I think, to promote on his website, just because you know, you want to keep the flock inside of the gate, and you don't want to expand it.
Well, what do you think of Gordon Duff's theory that the hysteria around the Jade Helm military exercises, which I think are disturbing, obnoxious, and, you know, raise questions about Posse Comitatus and so on, but Gordon is convinced that this whole thing is basically a kind of a Zionist psyop, that it's being pushed by Alex and his network, who are all Zionist agents, and that its purpose is to kind of rally the paranoid and increase paranoia among that kind of right-wing leaning segment of the audience, and prevent them from acting effectively, corral them into that sort of right-wing paranoid box where most of them, or a lot of them, are going to end up supporting a neocon presidential candidate. They're going to, basically, it's a psyop to increase paranoia, push people towards neocon thought. And of course, when summer comes and goes and we find that we're not locked up in concentration camps under Walmart, then everybody who said that we were going to be is going to look like an idiot. So that's Gordon's theory about Jade Helm. What do you think about that?
Well, definitely, I think that Alex Jones, one of his objectives is to make people paranoid. If you believe that the world is coming to an end next week, it's difficult to plan for the future.
Well, of course. Yeah, I just set up this huge Charlie Hebdo book tour that's going all over the continent this summer. Now, if I really thought that we were all going to be locked up in Walmart this summer, would I bother to put this much effort into busting the Charlie Hebdo false flag wide open? Probably not. What would I be doing? I'd be, I don't know, enjoying the last couple of weeks of freedom by, you know, having a barbecue with my family or something. I would stop my activism. And honestly, I really think that this paranoid vibe that Alex puts out, it may motivate a few people to do really paranoid activism for a couple of weeks and alienate everybody that they see, you know, get people to go out with a bullhorn in Walmart, start barking out, "You're going to be incarcerated in the tunnels beneath Walmart within 2 weeks!" You know, and everybody goes, "Wow, those conspiracy theorists are getting crazier all the time." And then 2 weeks come and go, and it doesn't happen. And then the person who was barking on the bullhorn burns out, and they don't become an effective activist. So, yeah, I think that paranoid vibe is a huge impediment to effective and strategic activism.
Yeah, again, I actually met a guy like that when I was in production with my movie. One of the most intelligent men I've ever met in my life. And he was totally convinced of everything Alex Jones. And when he found out, you know, when we told him, well, you know, he's an op and an operative, and he just went ballistic and he went nuts, and he just kind of, you know, finally became the realization that we were right, and he just kind of dropped out of society. I mean, it was terrible. You know, hopefully he's back on his feet again, but that's what that can do with you. And you know, you look at his videos, The End Game, and all these videos. Yeah, I think they're designed to make people paranoid, and it's not about telling the truth. It's about keeping people in a box.
Yeah, it kind of looks that way to me too. I mean, I used to try to give Alex credit, but, you know, he's so good at what he does. What he does, of course, includes making people paranoid and arguably reducing their effectiveness as activists, but it's still a heck of a show. I mean, it's kind of exciting. It's like, you know, watching a horror movie or an action thriller where it pumps you full of adrenaline. I think this kind of stuff makes people into adrenaline junkies. I know there's physiological research showing that people who do activities that give them a shot of adrenaline become addicts of adrenaline. and people whose jobs involve exciting or scary things where they get adrenaline jolts every so often become addicted to it. And if they don't get their adrenaline jolt, then they need something. And I think Alex is in some ways providing a sort of adrenaline jolt to a whole army of adrenaline junkies. And you know, some of the same people, I think, are actually involved in things like methamphetamine, maybe even crack for all I know, because those are stimulants that to some extent mimic the effect of adrenaline. So that kind of, you know, hyper fear and ego kind of mentality that Alex kind of naturally broadcasts does, I think, have some dubious effects. You know, I think the first thing we need to do in this kind of truth activism that we do is to relax a little bit and, you know, realize that it's not the end of the world. And maybe if it is the end of the world, even then it's not the end of the world, because we just need to have done the best that we can do up until the world ends, and then we'll all be judged. Of course, if you don't know that, I'm not saying believe it, I'm saying know that, because it's possible to know that. If you don't know that when you die, your whole life unrolls before your eyes, and if you've done pretty good, you'll be in a better eternity of consciousness with no body than if you hadn't. I mean, to me, that's, I know that from direct firsthand tasting or personal experience. So for me, it's just a no-brainer that you just do the absolute best while you're alive. You don't care if they come and kill you 5 seconds from now, this evening, tomorrow. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. The, you know, just doing your best while you're alive in a body is what you're here for. And so if you know that, then you know, you're still going to get a little jolt of fear here and there, maybe if somebody sneaks up and says boo, but you're not going to be living your life in fear. And I think that's a kind of a scary thing to the people who try to control us through fear, because especially, you know, since the demise of religion, you know, back in the days when religion ruled the West, people would try to behave themselves to a certain extent because they were afraid of what would happen to them in the afterlife, which actually I think is a very well-founded fear. Maybe not quite in the simplistic terms that's taught in dogmatic religious schools, but basically that's correct. But then religion got blown up, and we're living in the secular world where all there is this material space-time continuum, and what's there to live for other than trying to maximize your pleasure, minimize your pain, and avoid death for as long as possible, and once you die, then you know, everything sucks. So basically, life's trajectory really sucks in this worldview, because, you know, you start out healthy and young and athletic and having fun, and things just get worse and worse. You lose everything. You lose your health. You lose your friends. You lose everything you love. You're going to lose, and then you finally die. You know, I used to know somebody whose slogan was, life sucks, and then you die. And that's pretty much the summary of life in a secular society with a secular belief system. And I think that in that secular society and belief system, the authorities keep control of us, not by brainwashing us about the afterlife, but by brainwashing us about being afraid of things in this life, and especially being afraid of death. You know, there's this terror management theory that is a very elaborate academic theory about how the most basic human experience is fear of death. And anything that reminds us of our own impending death will cause a kind of fear that usually is unconscious and manifests itself in certain predictable types of behavior. So they manage our level of fear, manage our level of terror. It's a means of social control. They scare us. We're afraid that we're going to be, you know, we're going to die. We're going to be locked up in Walmart. They're going to kick in our door, whatever. This is all using fear to keep us in line. And if you want to learn how to really get out of line and actually change the world, you have to get outside the box of fear completely, to the point that you don't care if they're going to come and kill you. It doesn't matter at all. And that is, I think that's what's really scary to the powers that be. So they tolerate Alex Jones because he's injecting fear into the population and keeping them malleable and controllable.
Yeah, you know, another thing that he does too is he, when he does get on mainstream media, he acts like a crazy person.
So, have you noticed that?
Yeah. And, you know, you seen him on Piers Morgan talking about gun control.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a little over the top. I mean, the people who were really, really anti-gun control liked that because Alex was so strong. But I'm sure Alex alienated everybody that wasn't already on his side.
Right. Right. And that was the whole purpose of the skit with Piers Morgan. I've seen him on The View. He just goes crazy. And then the only people that like what he's doing are his ad followers. Everybody else, you know, the regular people, they look at them and go, "This guy is a nut."
Right. Yeah. You know, somebody after I was on Hannity, that was my first ever major TV interview. And so most of the people liked what I did on Hannity, even though I wasn't so sure that it went well. But one person did say, you know, you should probably like have one less cup of coffee next time you're on there, because I'd been a little kind of jerky and nervous. It was my first time on national TV. But compared to Alex, I was the model of calm. I was like the Buddha sitting there, because look at Alex on national TV. My God, he should like, you know, cut out at least 10 cups of coffee before he goes on.
Yeah, well, I'm sure these things are arranged in advance on what he's going to do, what he's going to say, and how crazy he's going to act.
You think so? You don't think he's just kind of, you know, doing it naturally?
No. They have to know what the result is going to be before they do these kind of interviews with him. They have to know what's to be expected, and you just don't get on TV without them knowing in advance what's going to happen. It just doesn't happen.
I don't know if they knew what was going to happen when they invited me on Hannity.
Yeah, well, they didn't let you talk.
No, that's true. Yeah.
They knew that that's what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This professor on there.
Get this guy on TV who's never been on TV before and make sure he doesn't get a chance to talk.
The other. If you were to try to talk sense and talk over Hannity, they would just cut your microphone. I mean, that's just...
No, that's not true. I did talk over him, and they didn't cut
your microphone. Yeah, I know, but it was difficult.
They probably wish they had.
Yeah, you didn't know what to expect. They did.
Yeah.
And so you're at a disadvantage at that point, and then they're always going to have a last word, you know, after you leave or something like that. You know, that crazy professor from Wisconsin, or, you know, you'll never be able to.
That's right. Yeah, I finally said, well, you should be taken off the air, and they said, see, he wants to silence the voice of the conservatives.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah, it's quite a media landscape we live in here, and in some ways it is turning into some kind of really weird stealth police state. So there was a story about, getting back to your experience with the FBI in Southern California, the den of espionage, and I think one reason that you're a part of the country is a den of Iranian-type espionage is because you are right in the heart of the Iranian gusano central, right? Gusano is the word the Cubans use to refer to the worms. That's what gusano means in Spanish, is worm. That's how they refer to the rich, spoiled, creepy, gangsterish, you know, Cubans who fled Castro and took their money and went to live in luxury in Florida and conspire with the CIA to try to kill Castro. So the Cubans call those people gusanos, counter-revolutionary worms. And the same is true of the Iranians, or most of them, not all of them, but most of them in Southern California. They're basically Iranian gusanos. They're people who liked the Shah better than the Iranian Revolution. They liked the Shah's CIA-built torture chambers. They liked the Shah being a slave of Israel. And they liked all of the vast amounts of money that they could easily make by being complicit in the brutal dictatorship of the Shah. And so when the Shah fell, they fled to Southern California, where they've been living in luxury ever since. And they've dedicated their whole lives to crushing the Iranian Revolution, returning their people to slavery and subjugation, and turning Tehran into even more of a sort of second-rate version of Los Angeles than it already is. So that's a pathetic bunch of people, and among those people, there are plenty of creeps who are willing to work with U.S. intelligence and police agencies and try to set up honest activists like you. So I do commend you for not falling into their wily grasp. Now, wasn't there a story, though, about somebody just got busted for this electronic smuggling to Iran? Was that related to this guy who came after you?
I think so. Yeah, because after I got home, I went on the internet and I looked it up, and it's about a month ago. They busted five people, some of them from Southern California, some of them from Texas. And I asked the agent, I go, "Was this one of those guys they busted?" And he goes, "Well, I can't tell you that." But But I'm thinking that it is that, or, you know, I didn't ask him if it was one of the guys they busted. I said, is this guy tied into that smuggling ring? And he said he couldn't tell me.
Oh, you know, probably they busted the guy and
right.
then, you know, gave him a deal like, okay, you're going to prison for the rest of your life unless you can deliver us Art Olivier, the master terrorist.
Yes. Yeah, that's what
He's
I think.
He's the head of Operation Terror.
Yeah. Yeah, because you know that's what they do with people they bust for drugs or whatever. They use them and try to get somebody, you know, a bigger fish. And
yeah, well, that's how they're getting all these poor retarded Muslim teenagers to sign on to FBI terror plots, is by using these slimy con artists who are really good at impersonating people and stuff. The FBI and the other police agencies sign up these con artists and say, okay, you're either going to go into jail for the rest of your life for all of these frauds that you've perpetrated, or else you can come perpetrate some new frauds for us. Go infiltrate the mosques, find retarded teenagers, and convince them to join you in blowing up the Sears Tower. And these con artists are doing it, and virtually every so-called Muslim terror plot since 9/11 has been basically this same story over and over and over.
Well, yeah, and they were doing it long before 9/11, too. I mean, that's just their mode of operation.
That's right. Well, I guess it sounds like you're probably in perfectly good, you know, legal shape, not having fallen for this shyster that they sent after you. But it does kind of make you wonder, you know, what will they try next? If they're going after dissidents and activists with these kinds of stings and scams, you know, where will they stop?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously this agent's got a green light to go after me. And yeah, that would make, you know, big headlines. Former Mayor Bellflower arrested in smuggling nuclear devices to Iran.
Well, it'd sell a few of your DVDs probably.
Yeah. But not enough to pay for all the legal fees and
right.
AOL or anything else. But
Yeah, you know, there has been pushback. You know, for a long time after 9/11, I got on board 2 years after 9/11, and you know, I didn't really do any real activism before that. But then when I heard about Griffin's work, I looked into it. I said, oh, my goodness. It's not just an inside job. It's like in your face. They didn't even try to hide it. You can prove it to anybody with, you know, two synapses firing. So that's when I got involved, was 2 years after. And by that point, I think the dust had settled a little bit. And most of the people who may have taken some, you know, serious interference from the bad guys early on, and I'm told that, well, according to my Veterans Today colleagues and their information, you know, you just have to evaluate it. And you know, anyway, they say that over 100 U.S. intelligence people were killed by the 9/11 cleanup crew. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, right after it happened, I think they were really coming down on people, trying to stop the truth from getting out quickly, because, you know, people's views of something like 9/11 are malleable only in the immediate aftermath. And once, as time goes by, the more time goes by, it's like, you know, give me the number for the number of minutes that have gone by since the false flag, and it will, you know, exponentially show that number taken to an exponent is the you know, the inverse of how powerful an exposure of the false flag is. So a lot of time goes by, the exposure of the false flag has an infinitesimal effect compared to if you do it right away. And so they cracked down on people right away. By the time I got involved 2 years later, they weren't really cracking down that much on people. And I think I had to really distinguish myself to even have them come after me at all, which I think they have in a couple of relatively minor ways. And but with this Charlie Hebdo thing now, you know, I got involved in exposing that in real time. Everyone, you know, this huge truth movement exposed the Charlie Hebdo false flag in real time as it happened, practically within hours after it happened. And then I got the book out, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, within 3 months. And I think that has led to more pushback. There, you know, I sense that, you know, the president of France is attacking me personally, comparing these conspiracy theories to the Holocaust, saying they have to be outlawed at the French, European, and international levels. And his think tank is calling me one of the world's 5 leading conspiracy intellectuals. And that's not a compliment. That means I need to be dealt with. So there's a ton of pushback right now over this Charlie Hebdo book. I think because it's, you know, all this activity is happening shortly after Charlie Hebdo happened, they're still pushing that same propaganda meme, and it's meeting a little bit of opposition because of the exposure that I'm participating in.
So that's what happened, you know, with that video about Sandy Hook, because it was so soon after the event happened that had that up there, and that it proved that it was a staged event. I had calls from people contact me, two people from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 True. They I don't think they had any positions with them, but that's how they identified themselves, is that they're part of the organization. And both of them told me that I needed to take down that video. one of them said that it was wrong because of one way, and the other one said it was wrong because of the opposite way. And I told the one guy, and I said, well, the other guy said that it was wrong because the totally opposite of what you said. He goes, oh yeah, I warned him about that. You know, so these guys were in collusion to get me to take that video down, because it's very important that, yeah, you don't get this information shortly after an event happens, because then too many people find out about it.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I have to deal with people who think that Architects and Engineers is basically some kind of front for the bad guys, and I certainly don't think it is as an organization.
I don't care.
But
I don't
care. Naturally, as the most successful political lobbying organization on 9/11 truth issues, they're going to get infiltrated. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. You know that they've got people who have volunteered and signed up and stuff. I mean, because how easy is it to deal with working for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth if you're an honest truther? You're going to put your job in jeopardy. You know, you're going to have to spend a lot of time that you're not getting paid for. It's a tough thing. And so it's going to be a problem for your reputation. So normal, honest people who are willing to volunteer for Architects and Engineers are going to be fairly few and far between. Whereas if you're a government agent or informant and the government is going to take 50 years off your sentence or give you a big pile of money for joining Architects and Engineers and then calling up Art Olivier and telling him to take down that Sandy Hook video and, you know, telling Architects and Engineers, don't deal with that Kevin Barrett. He's an evil anti-Semitic Muslim terrorist, all this kind of crap. You know, that is natural. So you know, you would have to believe in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy to believe that there's no infiltration of Architects and Engineers. But with a little common sense, you can see when that infiltration is manifesting itself, as it apparently did right after you put up that Sandy Hook video.
Right. Yeah, you know, Richard Gage, you know, I think he's a very hardworking person and very dedicated to the cause. But he has a board of directors that he has to deal with, and I think it's that maybe sometimes that the decisions that the board makes are not in the best interest of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I've seen that too. And sometimes, you know, I think some of the worst offenders or the people who are doing the most to really slow things down in the truth movement are people who pose as defending the truth movement against looking crazy. You know, there are two ways of screwing with the truth movement. One is to make us look too crazy, and of course there are people doing that. But the other is to say, oh, no, we can't do this, we can't do that, that would make us look crazy. Like, for instance, if we talk about any false flag since 9/11, we'll look crazy. So let's not go into this Charlie Hebdo thing. You know, let's not go into the Sandy Hook thing. And of course, that means this 9/11 drifts farther and farther back into history, and they accelerate their false flags to the point that they're doing one, you know, every couple of months or every couple of weeks or whatever they're doing now. And everybody in the 9/11 truth movement is just saying, no, 9/11, nothing but 9/11.
But even the 9/11 part, if somebody's doing some advanced research on 9/11, they will say, oh, no, you can't look into that because that'll make us look crazy.
Yeah, and exactly.
There's a thing on Facebook, it's called 9/11 Questions. And if you question the official 9/11 conspiracy theory, you're immediately taken off of that panel because they don't want anybody questioning their official story of the 9/11 conspiracy theory. And
the official unofficial story.
Yeah, the official unofficial story, right. Which is, you know, that it was thermite, nanothermite, alone led to the destruction of those buildings and nothing else. And And if anybody says anything otherwise, they'll try to destroy them. And they even put out, this organization even put out a video demeaning Governor Jesse Ventura, because Jesse Ventura says, well, no, it's got to be something more than just the thermite. And so they put it out that Niels Harriet schooled Jesse Ventura. That was the name of their video. And, you know, and this is a way to, you know, try to get the most high profile person that's on our side on this thing to just, you know, push away from the rest of us. You know, they, okay, these guys are a bunch of crazy people. I can't deal with this. You know, they, you know, all they do want to do is insult me when I'm out there stating their cause.
Yeah, I think they've been very effective. The infiltrators have been effective in stirring up trouble within the truth movement, which then right. alienates people outside of it.
Right. Inside and out, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't, because, I mean, you know, it's such a contradiction in terms when you have an organization that's called 9/11 Questions, and then if you bring up a question, you're removed from that group.
Right. And maybe it should be in no 9/11 questions. Exclamation
right.
point.
Right.
Well, hey, Art Olivier, I think we've hit the end of the interview. I congratulate you in avoiding this apparent FBI sting operation to try to entrap you for a bust. Art Olivier smuggling nuclear triggers into Iran. You know? I'm glad that didn't happen. And you're still working on your film projects. I do hope to catch you at some point, maybe in Tehran, maybe at a Charlie Hebdo book tour speaking event. Wherever it happens, it'll be good to see you.
Yeah, you too, Kevin.
All right, take care.
All right.
Bye.